Hi, folks. This is the Authority Smashing Hour. Here we are with David Bukola, Charnchi, also known as Chomsky, and Mr. 1001 Nights. How are you, David?
I am great. Good to hear you.
How's your, did you work hard this week? Were you a good wage slave this week, Dave?
I am one of the best wage slaves ever.
Yeah. Well, you're lucky, man, because a lot of us don't even have jobs.
Yes, no, I'm a lucky wage slave, that's for sure.
Yes.
No, there's a lot of people out of work right now. These are pretty hard times for a lot of people. Seems like most of my friends are out of work right now.
And do you feel this is having a radicalizing effect on the workforce, or do you feel this is not having the desired effect? Because, you know, there's a theory that when people hurt, then they'll start, you know, becoming more radical. But that's not always necessarily true, is it?
No, it's certainly not. I mean, there's a lot of different routes that people can take when times get rough. I mean, we saw that in Nazi Germany. We saw that in Italy. We saw it here in this country during the Great Depression. There was a large fascist movement. So, yeah, people don't naturally become radicals when things get tough. You know, they can also become counter-radicals or counter-revolutionary, if you will. The work to organize people is still there. You have a better opportunity, I think. You have a more open, opportunity to, make that connection with people. And they're open to ideas at this point because the status quo is certainly not working for them.
Right. I think there's a variety of situations in which solidarity can actually flourish. And perhaps a situation where people are more desperate, say after a war or something like that. But that doesn't have to be the only situation. People can build solidarity in all kinds of environments, and that's what we should be aiming for, right? As a labor movement.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. Our work never stops. I mean, we don't wait till capitalism, you know, crashes in on itself before we begin organizing. It's ongoing. Certain situations are a little easier to organize in than others, but, you know, the work's still there. It's always there.
So anyway, David, someone was talking about something that's supposedly so important, right? This new appointment by Obama of this Supreme Court.
But, yes.
But do you think we should care about something like that as anarchists?
Well, you know, the important question I think for us to ask, is this a good boss or a bad boss?
Right, right. Yeah. Well, I guess we don't like bosses too much, do we?
We don't like bosses at all. So,
right.
You know, I mean, it's a joke because obviously, as anarchists, as radicals in general, I think it's pretty irrelevant to the work we have at hand. You know, talking about organizing like workers and, students and different people, regardless of who's in the Supreme Court, that work remains. You know, it doesn't make our job any easier or any more difficult necessarily.
Right. Although reform can sometimes help give us a little breathing space for organizing.
Sure.
You actually spoke with Chomsky about this, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yeah, we spoke on May Day.
Should we go on and play a clip about it?
That would be great. Yeah, let's do that.
Happy May Day, Noam. It's a pleasure to be here with you today. Today is International Workers' Day.
And almost International Workers' Day. Everywhere outside the United States.
Correct. Yeah.
The United States is the one country where nobody knows what it is.
Yeah, that's why I think it's so important to maybe talk a little bit
about that. Ronald Reagan designated May 1st as what he called Law Day, a day of jingoist fanaticism, like an extra, twisting an extra knife into the labor movement.
Yeah. And even before that, wasn't it termed Loyalty Day?
Loyalty Day, yeah. It's a day of loyalty. I mean, there is a day in celebration of workers, but that's Labor Day when you go back to work.
Right.
But I don't think one in 100,000 Americans would know that May Day was a day of, and is in most places, a day of support for American workers in their struggle for an 8-hour day.
Yeah. And it's ironic considering that it all started here, right, in Chicago.
It started here, but then it became an international day in support of the American workers who were being brutally subjected to brutal violence and judicial punishment.
Yeah, that's actually something I want to talk to you about. Well, before we get into that, they were fighting for the 8-hour workday, and anarchists at that time were the driving force of the unions in Chicago.
Yeah.
And I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about that dichotomy that's seen between reform and revolution. And anarchists certainly, during the Haymarket Affair, realized the importance of fighting for something like the 8-hour workday with a grander vision.
But it's always been true.
Yeah.
I mean, if you take a look at, I suppose, the most venerable anarchist journal in the world, at least in the English-speaking world, is Freedom, which comes out of London. But if you look at its pages, a large percentage of it is dealing with reformist programs, supporting for workers' rights, for human rights, for decent pay, benefits, and so on. I mean, there's no contradiction there. I mean, you want to, if you're a serious revolutionary, and you really are looking for not an autocratic revolution, but a popular one, which will move towards freedom and democracy, you want to have the mass of the population who are implementing it and carrying it out and solving problems and so on. And they're not going to do it unless they have discovered for themselves that there are limits to reform. So sensible revolutionary will try to push reform to the limits, first of all, because it's helpful to people, so it's better to have an 8-hour day than a 12-hour day, and you want to do things that are just on ordinary ethical grounds, sure, you'll support them. But secondly, on strategic grounds, you have to show that the system, if it's true, maybe the system will collapse to reform, okay, that's fine, but if it won't, you have to reach the point where it resists, and there's nothing left but to take things over, maybe by force. That's basically self-defense. But unless people recognize coercion as a form of self-defense, they're not going to take part in it. At least they shouldn't.
So, and they learn that through their
you learn
their
it through your
right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you get to a point where the existing institutions simply will not bend to the popular will, well, you got to eliminate the institution.
So what did you think about that, David?
Well, I mean, it was, one, it was just a pleasure to spend May Day with Noam Chomsky. You know, that in and of itself was a real treat, I think.
Well, you know what I thought was interesting about it is this dual character of reform, that on the one hand, people insist that, and there's some truth to it, that the state is trying to sort of like appease the masses. But on the other hand, it also leads people to a realization of the limits of the system they're in. Anyway, what's going on with this hypocrisy about North Korea here? That Obama's talking about how the free world has to fight against this great threat. And of course, you know, no one in their right mind wants any government to have nuclear weapons, but, you know, isn't this double standard sort of a standard throughout the philosophy of powerful states?
Well, yeah, and I mean, one of the things that drives me nuts about this discussion, even, you know, well, the thing is, people will admit the United States used nuclear weapons. It's the only country to actually use these weapons, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But the reality is we've continued to use them over and over and again, up until the present. And what I mean by that, if I go into a bank with a firearm, whether or not I actually fire the weapon or not, if I'm brandishing it and intimidating people with it, I will go to jail for, you know, armed robbery, you know, because that weapon is used in the commission of a crime. The United States has repeatedly used its weapons of mass destruction to intimidate and bully other countries like North Korea, like Iraq, like Iran, and the list goes on and on. You know, we continue to bully the rest of the world and yet, you know, shake our little stick at countries who dare have the gall to want to defend themselves against these horrific weapons of mass destruction. The only things that can really be called weapons of mass destruction. And it's just insane. You have North Korea, who hasn't been in a war for, what, 50 years?
Right.
I mean, you know, come on. You know, and they're supposed to be this, you know, this threat to world peace. And you have the United States going around invading country after country for the last 50 years, disposing of democratically elected governments, you know, invading and occupying Iraq currently, Afghanistan. We have bases in, you know, what, over 150 countries right now, 700 military bases. It's ridiculous.
You know, and I guess this takes us to the point about this weekend, the Memorial Day weekend. I basically didn't pay much attention, but to the extent that I did, I saw a lot of people who were who still maintain that patriotic, nationalistic ethos, which I think is so unhelpful as far as solidarity and working class struggles goes.
Yeah, you know, I was fortunate enough to not notice any of that this Memorial Day weekend. We had a, here in New York, we had a benefit party for the new school people to pay off some of their legal fees. And I was basically surrounded by anarchists all weekend and didn't really have to see a lot of flag flying and, you know, jingoism.
Yeah, it's a bit scary because a lot of working class people actually are under that spell of nationalism, don't you think?
Oh yeah, it's very scary because the levels of violence that they'll go to you know, protect that, you know, that identity, I guess, you know, to protect the flag, whatever that means to them. Yeah, it's very scary. It's what we were talking about earlier, you know, with the things getting bad. Excuse me. There's you know, really no magic, you know, so the formula that says they're going to become radicals. You know, they could become, you know, very nationalistic, and, you know, you're going to have here, like we saw in Britain, where it's like, you know, British jobs for British citizens, and, you know, the American people are looking at that. So we have, like, here in this country, we have a large anti-immigrant thing going on right now, you know? So that's very scary.
Yeah, and in fact, the working class movement has always been an internationalist, all-encompassing movement. It's not a nationalistic, just-for-us movement, although we are, if of course, if it comes down to, you know, you or me, it's like war, right? Then we tend to say, well, it's better than I eat than you come from some other country and take my job, right? But we would prefer to organize as a class rather than along national lines. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we've always done that. I mean, you go back. I mean, we were mentioning May Day, the Haymarket anarchists. They were as internationalist as you can get. I mean, you look at like the Spanish Revolution. I mean, it was amazing because you had people from all over the world just flooding to Spain to like help fight, you know, the fascists. Beautiful. I mean, it was really internationalism. You know, it was just beautiful. And we've seen that again and again throughout, you know, anarchist history. And I think we continue to see it today. You know, we have like cross-border organizing campaigns. We just recently had a Starbucks go union in South America.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so these things are going on, you know. And so it's important that we continue to be international in our scope. You know, it's the old, you know, think globally, act locally. You know, I mean, our real work's going to be done locally, but there are things we can do to show solidarity with those in, you know, other places too.
I just heard that workers were also striking in South Korea. You know, I've seen a few videos on YouTube of these South Korean workers, and holy moly, I mean, they fight like hell. You know, they're pretty radical down there in South Korea, the labor unions. Have you ever seen any of their videos? Man. It's amazing.
Actually, this just past weekend, we had a friend from South Korea, and he was talking to us about, you know, the power of the unions in that country. He said it's pretty formidable.
Yeah, I mean, when you see the police fighting there, they use anything they can. They use these water cannons, which, by the way, they stopped being used here in the United States after the civil rights movement because of the incompatibility of the image of a water cannon just smashing people with, you know, the traditional concepts of freedom that America supposedly stands on. And that's another reason why we need to, you know, sort of focus on the propaganda aspect of it, because a lot of the a lot of the control has to do with ideological control. And that's where nationalism comes in. That's where entertainment comes in. That's where all these other features of the system basically keep us down.
Yeah, and they didn't give up on violence entirely. They do have tasers and rubber bullets and plenty of other ways to incapacitate us. You know, so they might have given up on the water cannon, but they had a bag full of other ways to really hurt us.
Yeah, and so what did you think about, I don't know if you saw, I think her name is Elaine Briard or something like that. She works at the Harvard Trade Union Program, and she was interviewed on the Real News Network, and she was talking about how the latest poll showed that about 53% of American workers would join a union if they had the chance, and of course about 25% of the rest didn't actually know if they would do it or not. But only a minority said they did not want to do it. And the United States apparently has the highest difference between the salary of non-union workers and the salary of union workers. It's something like 30%. I think Europe is maybe 25%, something along those lines. But the highest difference in the salary is here in the United States. So people know that if you're a union worker, you're likely to make higher wages. On the other hand, they also know if you try to organize,
you're going to lose your job.
Right, right. So labor law, particularly I remember that you made a video about this new law that people are trying to pass called the Employee Free Choice Act. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the Employee Free Choice Act is it's big labor's love child, I guess we could call it. It has a lot of different provisions in it. One of the main provisions that a lot of unionists like is card check, which would allow organizers to go into a shop, and once they get 51% of once they get a majority of workers to sign union cards, basically saying they want to join a union, then the employer has to recognize them and engage in collective bargaining. The way it is now, the employer can force an NLRB election process, which takes months. And during that process, what they do is they find out who the organizers are, who the main union sympathizers are. They pressure them, they intimidate them, they bribe them, and oftentimes they fire them. Once you see, and I've been in these campaigns, once you see the main people involved in trying to organize a workplace get fired, it sends a pretty chilling message to the rest of the employees who may or may not know that much about unions, who, like you said, maybe the extent of their knowledge is that they might make more money. But the reality is, not only will you make more money, you'll have a safer work condition, you'll have more respect on the job, and your employer can't treat you in the willy-nilly fashion they do in non-union shops where, obviously in most places the employer has all the power. And as an individual, we have very little power, but collectively, we tend to even that power out. So the Employee Free Choice Act, that's one of the main provisions that people are excited about. It has some drawbacks from a radical analysis, one being that it would allow some of the big business unions who don't do very good organizing to go in and just, run shops, turn them union, Teamsters, carpenters, whatever. And I am a union carpenter, without having very much, input from the rank and file. So that's a concern, a radical concern.
This sort of like really highlights the fallacy that we live under voluntary conditions, because the fact is that all these workers are being held back from their desire to unionize. It's not like of course the bosses want to make it seem like, this is going to force you to be a union member. No, but we're forced to work for them. We're forced to work for the bosses. Most people, if they had a chance, they actually would join a union.
So yeah, well, and the bosses organize all the time, I mean, you can look at it any number of ways. The Chamber of Commerce is one example. The Alliance of Business Contractors, the ABC.
We have some questions here from the audience. One guy asked about Prop 8. Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, as a my own personal feeling is, you know, I'm not really concerned about gay marriage. Although we were talking about reforms earlier, you know, and I think they can have a pretty, they can have unintended consequences. And one of the neat things I think about the gay marriage thing that's going on around our country in the various states is that it does question heteronormativity. It questions, it gets people thinking about relationships and sexuality and all these things in ways that weren't maybe discussed that long ago. So it, you know, it does push the envelope in a way, not in a way I would necessarily like. And but I know just from talking to people, it's making a huge difference in people's lives. So, you know, and that's pretty cool.
You know how liberals tend to focus a lot on certain issues because they're non-economic issues. I mean, and obviously it's true that that we want to work on issues like gay marriage and stuff like that. You know, but the fact of the matter is that very often that's sort of a cop-out, I feel, because they don't want to look at some of the deeper issues that are troubling the working class and people in general.
Yeah, well, and, I mean, there are economic concerns with the gay marriage thing where, you know, this happened to my uncle, actually. When his partner died, most of the money was in his name and didn't, you know, it's not like a normal marriage where they were in Kansas, you know, so the money didn't go to him, you know, the estate, all these different things. So, you know, there are economic things where the state, within a gay marriage system, it'd be a little easier for you to pass your estate on to your lover. But then, as anarchists, I don't want that going on anyway. You know, I mean, that's part of the problem. You know, so and you know, just the idea of marriage. I mean, marriage is based on property. It's a transit. It's all about property. I mean, it used to be the wife was a form of property that was transferred from the father to the husband. So as an institution, it's something I'm against. And so it's very difficult, I think, talking with progressives or liberals and, you know, talking about I'm happy for them if, you know, they're happy for this. I mean, they're obviously not happy that the ban on gay marriage was upheld. But, like, things in Vermont and the various states that have passed gay marriage things, it doesn't do a lot for me. You know, I'm not excited. I can't be excited about gay marriage just like I can't be, you know, really excited about gays in the military. I don't want anybody in the military, let alone gays, you know?
So the whole framework is kind of wrong in some ways.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a loaded question because, you know, the institution itself I'm already against. So whoever's doing it, I'm not really for, you know, whether it's gays or straights or, you know, dogs, cats. I don't want my dog getting married.
Right. I mean, I guess some people view marriage sort of as a ceremonial step to strengthen a commitment between two people.
Sure. But you have to wonder, like, where's the state's role in that? I mean, I mean, ostensibly it could be like a beautiful thing where, you know, in front of all your closest friends, you commit yourself to this other person. But then you have this weird thing where you want the state to get involved and the church and this real, I really don't want anything to do with it.
Yeah, I think I agree to a large extent. So this a user here by the name of Large Carrot, and he's asking, how does an anarchist society treat guns as in personal firearms? Well, this is an interesting question. What do you think about that, David?
Well, I mean, I don't know what an anarchist society is, you know. To be quite honest, I mean, I have my own ideas. I think you have your own ideas. I don't think it's something that we can even really tackle at this point. But, I mean, I understand the question, like, what is our take? I think generally anarchists believe we need to, you know, defend ourselves, and, you know, certainly arm ourselves. To some extent, me personally, I have no interest in firearms. You know, I think that's, you know, as anarchists, I think we believe in this. You know, the individual does have, you know, we're going to disagree on certain things. And as a personal thing, I have no interest in firearms at all. I don't know how you feel.
Yeah, I think one question that needs to be raised here is whether or not we need to defend ourselves and who our real enemy is. So right now, I did a video on YouTube a few weeks ago about how around 65,000 workers die every year in the United States from work-related injury and illness. And and that's more than actually die from people who otherwise would not have been killed if they had firearms. So, right. so the question here is, people who obsess over I need to defend myself right now by getting a gun, you would be better off if you actually formed a union, because that would actually improve the conditions at your workplace and you know, maybe save your life. So we have to set priorities here. Once again, the anarchist principle is that authority is illegitimate until it proves itself legitimate. So the same thing for firearms. Do you need a big firearm to defend yourself? Yes, maybe under some circumstances. Certainly the Spanish anarchists would have needed more guns to defend themselves. Of course, you know, you had Mussolini and Hitler who were sending arms to the to Franco. It all depends on the circumstances. But right now, the priority is not guns. I mean, guns... Yeah. Guns are not going to bring about a liberation of the masses. They may be as a tactical weapon at some sort of point in the future. Maybe they'll be useful, but we can't really focus on that as a lot of people actually do. They focus on guns as if that was the only thing that mattered for liberty.
Well, and I think, I mean, we look around the world, and the United States clearly has a monopoly on the use of force and violence around the world. And I think it's kind of naive to think that, you know, we're going to arm ourselves somehow and defend ourselves from this tyranny. The reality is that if we're going to defend ourselves, it's going to be in a nonviolent fashion, I think, in this country. You know, like you said, it depends on the you know, the space and time and the, you know, what we're dealing with. And unless we're planning on arming ourselves with tactical nuclear weapons or something, which I certainly don't advocate.
And here's where Chomsky's comment in his 1974 interview with
the BBC.
When he talks about, well, would these countries, let's say, like, say a small country undergoes an anarchist revolution, and then Chomsky says that it's very likely that they would be attacked by one of the two major powers, right? Either Russia, back then, either the USSR or the United States. And he says, yes, they could be armed, but that would not prevent an attack by a stronger country. So what he said is that their best weapon would actually be the appeal of that revolution to the working class of that very country. And that was another thing during the Spanish Civil War. Apparently, Franco used what they call the Moors, the people from Morocco, who were basically colonized. It was sort of a Spanish colony, so they could use these basically, you know, enslaved people to fight to fight against their very own class in Spain, because these people were working class as well. What the strategy could have been is to actually try to stir up anti-colonial sentiment within Morocco in order to bring those people into the working class consciousness, rather than you know, just trying to fight the situation just through guns. So there's more ways around fighting oppression than just violence, because they tend to be better in the area of violence most of the time, right?
They're really good at it. They kill like nobody's business. And, you know, as anarchists, I think we're always concerned with, you know, the ends and the means, you know, and we want to, you know, it's like the old, we're not going to use the state to create a stateless society, you know, if we want a peaceful society, we're not going to use violence, you know, I mean, to create a peaceful society, we're going to use peace, you know, and I think we live in a time and place, in this country at least, where that is a real possibility, you know, of, you know, pushing reforms like Chomsky talks. I mean, a very real thing we could do. I mean, these giant corporations that are, you know, killing the planet are chartered by states, you know. They're things that can be, you know, undone within the state. There are other, you know, mechanisms that we can push for, you know. And those reforms in and of themselves, like we were talking about, push people to see the limits of the state and to hopefully think beyond it, you know, and think of what else can we do. If this is the most we can do within this system, let's think of something else.
You spoke about peace, and I know that you're practicing Buddhist. In fact, maybe not a very normal combination between anarchist and Buddhist. And I'm wondering what insights into peace and into tactical issues do you derive from your Buddhist practices?
Well, I mean, the reality is that violence, you know, is something that's going to happen. And, you know, a lot of people think Buddhists are pacifists, and they're not. I mean, a lot of the martial arts are derived, partially at least, from Buddhist teachings about violence and the idea that, you know, self-defense is a real necessity. And, you know, at the same time, we don't want to, you know, cause too much harm to our opponent necessarily. And it goes back to, I think, what you were talking about earlier with our real appeal isn't going to be to confront our enemy with force and violence, which they tend to be very good at, but the fact that we're right, you know, that people should have access to the things of this planet, that we can organize ourselves in a non-hierarchical fashion based on things like cooperation and mutual aid and the basic premise being that a better world is possible. And that in and of itself should be enough. That doesn't mean the work's easy or, you know, that they won't use force and violence against us, but that's where the self-defense comes in, solidarity, and being international. All those different things come into play. And I think that's where, you know, at least for me, like when I see, like we were just at a party this weekend. It was a fundraiser for the new school, the people who occupied the new school here in New York. And an army of police officers came in and, you know, typically beating people up. And it's like, what are you doing that? You know, I mean, are we going to arm ourselves against the police? You know, these are questions. And as a Buddhist, you know, I make my own decisions based on what I think is appropriate, you know, what's going to cause the least amount of harm, both to myself and to others.
So what do you think about the situation where Netanyahu, the right-wing president of Israel, right now it's basically saying, no, we're not going to stop settlement expansion, which it's interesting because before, you know, the doves, the you know, the liberals, they basically continued expansion under the pretense of peace, et cetera, et cetera. But but it seems that Netanyahu is a little bit more like Bush, where he's just more blatant about it. In some ways, right-wingers are a little bit more honest because
they are. Yeah.
Because liberals sort of like do pretty much the same thing, but then everything is sort of wrapped in this rhetoric of peace and diplomacy, et cetera, et cetera, which is kind of like what's happening with Obama.
Right, yeah, it's you know, it's this good cop, bad cop routine that I don't know when we're going to get tired of it. I mean, we've seen it play out enough in our own country and other countries, and you know, the basic policies kind of remain the same. Maybe they get escalated a little bit, or you know, they change, but I mean, within a certain you know framework, they're not a lot different, you know. And you're seeing that with Israel. Israel has continued to violate UN resolutions and international law and just thumb its nose at the world, basically. And but it only does that in a context of being, you know, basically an offshoot of the U.S. military, you know. So, I mean, it's really unfortunate. I don't know when we're going to, you know, stop thinking, oh, this is, you know, like you said, with Obama. I mean, Obama's basically carried out most, if not all, Bush's policies, you know, maybe change the names of them, fired Blackwater, but hired another, you know, private security company that does the same thing. And, you know, I don't know. It's you got to wonder how long this can go on, that people will just say, you know, this is ridiculous. We've got to start fighting back.
Yeah, you know, with the Obama thing, you know, from the very beginning, I've been warning people, look, all these slogans, all these PR slogans, are just that, slogans. Because at the end of the day, he's going to commit close to the same atrocities, close to the same injustices as his predecessor. And now, a few months after his presidency, we see exactly that. I mean, everything is becoming more and more visible.
Yeah, and I don't know what your experience is, but mine is at least that working class people tend to see through the BS a little more easily, I think, because they're not so indoctrinated in the educational system. It's almost like talking to a wall, I think, when I talk to more educated people about Obama, for instance. I mean, they really can't see, he seems like such a good guy and he says these nice things and, you know, they really want to believe that he's doing something different than Bush. And at the end of the day, at least he doesn't have that nasty little smirk on his face when he tells us these things. And, you know, he speaks English well. And it can be very mind-numbing to speak to people like that because they really want to believe that he's this force for good in the world. And, that can be very difficult.
Yeah, and I think that sort of feeds into the European self-image because the Europeans have openly stated that they think Obama is much closer to their own way of doing things, to their own philosophy. And if you look at the history of European colonialism, exploitation, atrocities, et cetera, it's extremely brutal. But they have learned to be more subtle about it than the United States. So a lot of people look at Europe and say, well, you know, they're civilized, they do all these things, and I mean, in some ways they are, but of course you've had pretty strong working class movements there that have won things like universal healthcare in some countries, et cetera, et cetera. But the truth remains, they have governments over there, they have corporations that control the economy, they have basically the same situation that we have here, maybe not as extreme, but we should not have any sort of illusions about what the bosses all around the globe think and do.
Yeah, in one respect, though, I think Europeans in general are a little more class conscious, whereas Americans typically have no idea what class they're in. Everyone thinks they're middle class. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're making $1,000 a year or $200,000 a year or whatever. Everyone thinks they're middle class in this country. Basically, people perceive it as a classless society, and I don't think you see that so much in Europe. People are more class conscious. You know, they realize that there's a class struggle going on. I think that's one of the reasons the unions are so strong there. That, I think, is something we need to learn from.
Another thing that we may actually have to consider is that we have to clean up our own acts, sort of purify our own minds, because the state is not only out there, it's also inside of us, right?
You sounded like a Buddhist.
I think Buddhism, even though I'm not a Buddhist, but I've sure. always sort of admired some of the precepts of Buddhism, and even Christian anarchism in some ways has relatedness to that sort of philosophy.
Yeah, and that's something for everyone to basically, you know, I'm sure they're not going to push any kind of faith on anybody, but it's certainly something, like we've talked about it before, if we could blink our eyes and the state was gone tomorrow, we would just rebuild the damn thing. I mean, we're really, you know, not in the mind frame to live in a stateless society at this point, you know? I mean, we're not organized for one, you know, I think people will organize themselves, but the way that we will organize ourselves, because we're so used to hierarchical, bureaucratic organizations, that's what we'd recreate, because that's all we know. You know, most people, when you speak to them, you talk about horizontal organizations and, leadership thing, you know, movements, and they look at you like you're crazy. So, I mean, that's a real concern, developing that mind frame. The way we do that is, of course, by creating those real living examples here in this world, and by living those, we do through that practice, we purify our minds, and make ourselves ready for that future that we envision.
We have a question here from another user. His name is J.R. Pig, and he says, "Why don't we see more anarchists come out to support the anti-statist direction of pro-capitalist libertarians, like the people, like the Tea Party people?" Okay, I guess I'll give my answer to that first.
Sure.
First of all, these people really want to privatize the state. They're not truly anti-statist because they don't stand for a solidarity-based ethos of society. They believe in bosses, and they believe in security for private ownership of the means of production. They don't see a distinction between exploitative and non-exploitative property, and they don't see anything wrong with wage slavery. So we don't think that that is consistent with a true libertarian anarchist history of struggles that stand against hierarchy. Wouldn't you say that as well, David?
Yeah, why? I guess the question is basically why didn't we? Why weren't more anarchists, I guess, supportive of these Tea Party things? Anarchists that I know generally saw it as a joke because of the fact that it wasn't a grassroots movement. It was funded and paid for by Fox. If you went the little thing they did here in New York City, it was Fox person after Fox person followed by Newt Gingrich. None of these people are anti-state. I looked at the list of speakers at various events they had. I don't know how any anarchist, whether they think they're pro-capitalist or not, which I find it odd. But regardless, if you think you're anti-state and you supported that, it's very odd because none of the speakers that I saw were anti-state. They were for a minimal government, and that minimal meaning no social programs. But of course, we will continue to fund, the high-tech sector and various forms of the economy through the Pentagon and whatnot. I don't know how any anarchist could really get behind that. And the fact that it was funded by a giant corporation that is, of course, chartered by the state and, like Fox News, who utilizes public airwaves, to basically, propagandize the population. I don't know how anyone can get excited about that. It's not a grassroots movement. It's not something I can, jump into. But go ahead, John.
One of the things that we learned, or at least I learned when I went to Boston and spent the weekend with you guys and interviewed Thomas Ferguson, the author of The Investment Theory of Party Competition, was that this illusion that capitalists can have a society just based on their individual desires and prerogatives, that is wrong. Ferguson clearly showed that the state functions primarily to manage the collective interests of the capitalists, with one party being more controlled by certain industries, perhaps more capital-intensive industries or industries more in favor of free trade, and another party more protective of the interest of more labor-intensive industries, which are perhaps more protectionist. So you have the state, obviously, as a collective protector of the capitalist class, is not always going to be favorable to the entirety of the capitalist class for every single thing. These so-called libertarian capitalists, they don't see how the state develops and if in fact exists to protect the interests of these capitalists.
Right. I mean, and the capitalists themselves don't always see it. I think that's kind of important to recognize. I mean, we can go back to, we're in similar times to the Great Depression right now, and there was a coup attempt against FDR by sectors of the capitalist class who felt he was going too far in these social programs. All the things we're hearing about Obama, although Obama's not doing nearly as much as FDR did in this respect, but there was the similar cries of socialism and all these things, which were closer to being true with FDR than they certainly are with Obama. But the fact was that there were elements within the capitalist class that were so outraged by this that they attempted to overthrow the president through a coup using the famous Marine Smedley Butler. And it didn't, this is public record. So the reality is that the capitalists themselves aren't always cognizant of what the state is doing in their best interest. Because FDR was certainly aware that he was forestalling a revolution, taking counter-revolutionary measures by implementing things like Social Security and these big public works programs. He certainly wasn't a socialist, and he was trying to avert a revolution. The capitalists themselves aren't always aware of this, and that's kind of important to remember. So when these Tea Party guys, it's really easy to get caught up, I guess, in that furor, but it's fake. Remember, Fox News you know, Payton basically created that whole Tea Party thing. And even with all that money and all that advertising, what were they able to get 200,000 people across the country? Can you imagine if we had that kind of access to mainstream airwaves and to push an agenda?
I think here we have to distinguish between true grassroots movements, independent, solidarity-based grassroots movements, and the ones that are manufactured by the powers that be. So to give you the most obvious example, which we all know about, was the Obama so-called grassroots campaign, which featured, you know, hundreds of thousands of people around the world, but in fact was not a true people's movement. They were just, as Chomsky pointed out, it was an army of obedient followers, and they were not really trying to articulate their own desires and trying to push some sort of a platform for Obama to follow. They were following Obama. And the way a democracy should work is that we should articulate what we want, and then our delegates would be sort of expressing those needs in some sort of federation, council, assembly, whatever it may be.
Yeah, I mean, well, and Obama was the movement, which was interesting in and of itself. You know, the movement wasn't to, say, implement universal health care or, you know, create union jobs or any kind of thing that Americans could really rally behind. The thing was Obama. He was the movement. So, you know, you're left with he'll do whatever he's going to do, and he's been pretty honest about what he was going to do. I don't, you know, I mean, as much as we criticize him, he has been pretty honest about the things that he said he was going to do, and he's kind of held to them to a large extent.
Right, right. I mean, I guess not completely honest, but yeah, to some extent, he said, you know, I'm a centrist Democrat, you know.
Yeah. I'm sure, you know, he's been deceitful in ways, but I mean, he basically told us who he was and what he was about, you know. There's no surprise there. It wasn't like he was a closet Marxist and didn't tell us about it, or, you know, some revolutionary leader. You know, he told us who he was.
And that's another thing. I mean, people just still don't look at the basics of our system, that even if you had the most radical person, I mean, it was Bakunin who said, get the most radical revolutionary out there, put him on the throne of all the Russias, and before you know it, you'll have someone who's worse than the Tsar himself. And the thing is that he could be the most revolutionary guy in the world. You have a system of power in place, and that is what determines policy, and that is what actually what has the biggest influence on the psyche of particularly the people on top, because the higher up you are, the more compliant you have to be with the powers that be.
Sure. And I mean, I think everyday people can see this in their own lives. If you've ever been put in a position of power in your job place, you know, your choice is to either change. I mean, you know, people think, oh, I'm the nicest person, I'd be the nicest boss in the world. But when you get into that position of power, you realize you can't be the nicest person in the world. That you are, you know, answering to different levels of power, and that if you are that nicest person in the world, you will soon be out of a job. And Obama knows this. Every person who's ever put in any kind of position of power over other people soon either realizes this or loses their job very, very quickly.
Yeah. I think this is a perspective that we also need to extend to the person who asked the question earlier about a deregulated capitalist society, which I guess they envision as sort of a many small businesses trading with each other, which is sort of a version of capitalism which has never existed for any prolonged period of time. Capitalism has always tended toward concentration. But nevertheless, if you're a business and you have 10, 20, 30, 40 employees, 50 employees, it's true you're not a big corporation, but the basic relationship between owner and wage laborer is in many ways the same as a big corporation. The owner has maybe a more personal perspective or something like that, but in fact the it's not like we anarchists are aiming toward a society of small businesses with only 20, 30, 40 employees. I mean, we're really looking at a self-managed society. You don't have the subordinate hierarchical structure which these capitalist institutions entail.
Right, And, you know, I mean, that's, I think people lose, focus on that, that it's not just economics, you know, I mean, it's the, that relationship of, you know, we went from selling the fruits of our labor to renting ourselves on the market, you know, and that does something to you as a person, you know, it's not good. And when you look at the early labor papers, that was the thing they railed about the most. The economics was a concern because their wages certainly decreased. But the fact that they lost their dignity, they lost their sovereignty, they lost their respect as a human because you're renting yourself. You know, that's just another name for, you know, being a slave. You know, I can buy you or I can rent you, you know. But at the end of the day, you're not in control over yourself. I am, as the boss. And that's, you know, sick.
Primitivists talk a lot about alienation, how civilization brings about alienation. And I may even agree to some extent with that, but there's so much alienation that we could get rid of within our framework by managing a society based on eliminating the hierarchical elements of capitalism and the state. We can really eliminate a huge percentage of the problems that we currently have and that the environment is having, because we're destroying the environment through our hierarchical institutions.
Right, right. No, I mean, there's a lot we've got a lot to do here. We've got a lot to fix here. You know, and going back to the anarcho-capitalist perspective, you know, it's funny to me that they would ask why we don't support them in their movements. I mean, as far as I know, that's the only thing that they've been involved in, were these little tea parties.
Yeah, right.
How about they show up to things that we're involved in? And I have an example. If there's anybody here in New York City, we have the Stella Doro strike going on, and we have a call for people to get involved. If I could just give a shout out to that. That'll be Saturday, May 30th at 12 noon. We're going to assemble and rally at the Target Mall on West 225th Street, one block east of the Major Deegan Expressway, then march up Broadway to rally at the Stella Doro Factory. So this is May 30th at 12 noon. It's a Saturday. If you're in the New York area, get involved. I mean, this is grassroots. These are working class people. These are people that need your help. It's not Fox News. This is real. This is a real struggle. So, you know, when you guys start coming out to our things, you know, then maybe we will find issues that we can unite on. You know, I don't see that as impossible, you know.
So anyways, with that, I think we'll wrap it up. Remember, this show is every Tuesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific Time. And the hosts are Buddha Jam and Mr. 1001 Nights from YouTube, with the help of Chomskyan, another excellent YouTuber. And with that, we're going to wrap it up. So, talk to you later.
Peace.